Hello, fellow friends, family degenerates, and welcome to another edition of Caged Wisdom MMA. My name is Josh, and I am your host, along with my co-host, Buck Schlurf over MMA Nerd.
Say hello, Buck. That's me crying like a two-year-old, because it's...
I don't know what he's doing either,
It's guys. 2 years. This is 2 years of Caged Wisdom.
2 years. 2 years of Caged Wisdom. Passion project. And yeah, we're still going. Great to have you on board. And yeah, we just looked at it, 24 episodes in. I think I started in February. You came on board in March. And now, yeah, we're making our mark. So happy anniversary.
Oh, shucks. You shouldn't have.
Yeah. Well, I did. So here we go, guys. UFC 299 is right around the corner. And then we have UFC 300 coming up, which is going to be a pretty epic card. But UFC 299 has got some great fights on it.
Yeah, it's really good.
It's got some great fights on it. I feel like the UFC has shifted a little bit from what it was in 2021, 2022, and even part of 2023. I feel like the cards are more stacked now. Do you remember we went through a little bit of a lull period where the undercard, but the main card was so watered down except at the top end, that you didn't even know who was going to be fighting on it, or you didn't know the names of the people who were fighting on it. And we follow the sport religiously. So we're going to get into that in a little bit here. We're going to be going and breaking down each every fight. Again, we are not a betting platform, but we're going to give the odds and we're going to give our take on what we think the outcome is going to be and how we think it's going to go down. Before we get started in that, I know that, Buck, you had a couple things you wanted to talk about the current state of MMA. So why don't you start there?
Right. So the big news story going on right now is Bloody Elbow is a MMA news and journalism site. They used to be owned by Vox Media, and then the owner bought them back.
It's one of the first ones.
Uh-huh. Back in 2007.
Yeah.
They're independent journalists doing really great reporting, and they were following along this antitrust lawsuit very closely. And that's where I was getting most of my information that I've been sharing with you guys. That company, Bloody Elbow, just was purchased this last month by a company called GRV Media. They are, I'm reading their title, a digital publishing and content monetization platform. They purchased Bloody Elbow. They bought the site, the logo, the trademarks, and the social media sites, and did not bring over any of the writing staff. And then since they have been in control of the site, they have deleted all of the articles pertaining to the antitrust lawsuit. So anything that you had, any links that you might have.
Suspect.
Yeah, very suspect. Any links that you might have, any articles that were posted on Twitter or anything else like that, they all go to error 404, you know, page not found. So you can still follow them on Substack, is I believe where they're posting most of their content right now. And they're going to try and rebrand and move forward with like a more limited staff in the future. We don't know how it's going to go, but I think it's important that we continue to support independent MMA journalism so that we get this kind of, get this reporting. And we're not going to get it from whatever Bloody Elbow is going to become. It doesn't look like that's...
Do we know who the parent company is of GRV?
GRV Media. I looked into it. I tried to find see if there was any ties to like Endeavor or any of the, you know, the...
Sure. I mean, it would make sense if they took all that stuff down.
Yeah, I wasn't able to find anything, but I'm not a really great reporter or an investigative journalist. But it is, if it happened immediately, they bought the company, all the staff was fired, and all those articles were removed. They said in a press release that they're going to take the content of Bloody Elbow in a different direction, which doesn't sound great to me.
I mean, the only direction they were going was like MMA news.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And now I think
it makes you
it's
wonder.
MMA puff pieces now, I think. It's just going to be.
For sure.
Look who said what on Instagram. So.
Yeah, that's interesting because I went there and checked it out after he told me that, and he was spot on. There was something right off the bat. You go to bloodyelbow.com. in a Google search, and the first thing it says is Kid Nate is to blame. Apparently, Nate is Nate Wilcox, who is the gentleman that created Bloody Elbow, and you said bought it back. And under the article, it says it's been a wild couple of days for the staff at Bloody Elbow, who ... When you click on the link, first thing it does is 404 error, page not available.
Yeah.
So people are being silenced. I'm sure it's going to come out here at some point, but that's interesting. It just goes to show the scope and the depth of the resources that you know UFC has, and maybe even ESPN and Disney have a play in all this. I mean, who knows? Because they have a lot of financial interest in it. A couple of things you wanted to talk about too. Now, I didn't know much about this guy before Buck brought him to attention, but there's a guy fighting on Saturday, yes, right? Named Robelis.
Robelis. Why don't you tell us about Robelis? I want to say is his name. He's he's a right. Cuban Taekwondo Olympic medalist. He competed, over a decade ago, which is kind of crazy to say. Back in 2012, he competed, and I think he won bronze in the heavyweight category in Taekwondo. Right now, he is 4-0. In his MMA career, he's making his debut. He's got 4 wins, all in the first round. All of them are knockouts. They are in 4 minutes and 54 seconds, 12 seconds.
That was his first
12
one.
12 seconds, 4 seconds, and 3 seconds.
That is incredible. Yeah, I think 2 of those would be the UFC record. Because I think it's, 6 seconds or 7
5
seconds?
Or 6 for Masvidal, yeah. He is like 6'8", and he's got like a 7'2" reach. It's 85 inches. It's the longest reach in the UFC, beating John Jones and Stefan Struve, who were tied at 84-inch reach. So he's fighting Josh Parisian.
Yeah, go check him out.
It'll be...
Yeah, that's going to be
catch him on the undercard.
I think most people watch that to see him. Yeah, on the undercard. He is 35, though.
Heavyweight. And he's cute. Yeah, I mean, Yoel Romero's what, like 46?
He might be 47.
Yeah, those Cubans age a little bit slower, apparently.
Yeah, who knew?
Who else is on the undercard?
That's for sure.
Curtis Blaydes.
Yeah, there's some really good fights on the undercard. Undercard could be, we were talking about, it could be headlining an Apex event.
It
could
have headlined last week. I would have appreciated it. Curtis Blaydes versus Gilton Almeida is on the undercard, and Mateusz Gamrot versus Rafael Dos Anjos is also on the undercard. So, really...
Gilton is one that I've got pegged as a possible title holder.
Suffocating top pressure. We just watched him...
And Mateusz is also, I think, going to be a top 3 guy for a while. So, God, there's a lot of talent on that. I mean, arguably, they could have been put in the main card, no problem. But that just goes to show you how stacked this main card is. And we do have one person that you, unless you really follow MMA, you're probably not going to heard of that's in the main card, which is Michael Venom Page, that we'll get into. But that's going to be a really, really exciting fight. So, yeah, you just want to jump into this? Let's go for it. All right. So I'm going to give the whole main card breakdown in terms of the fight odds right now. Then we'll go to each one individually. So kicking off the main card is Peter Yan, -115, taking on Song Yadong at bantamweight, who is -105. We have Gilbert Burns, +140, taking on Jack Della Maddalena at welterweight, who's at -166. Kevin Holland, -135, taking on Michael Venom Page, who's +114 at welterweight. Dustin Poirier, +170, and strangely, taking on Benoit St. Denis, who's -205 at lightweight. And then finally, for the bantamweight title, we have Sean O'Malley, -258, taking on Marlon Vera, +180, again, at bantamweight title. So, first fight, I mean, all these fights have great storylines behind them. Peter Yan, you know, this is an interesting case study. This is a guy that I thought was going to, without question, be a title holder for a while when I saw him taking on. I mean, who he beat? Didn't he beat Uriah
Faber?
He
beat him pretty bad, once? And he won the title.
Right?
It was a vacant title that he won against Jose Aldo in a fight that was competitive at the beginning and not competitive at the end. I mean,
No, I mean, he looked like a world beater yeah. for a while, and then he went on a three-fight skid. So currently on a three-fight skid, which is uncharted territory for this guy because he's 16-5. He's 31 years old. He lost to Aljamain Sterling, which is the
DQ loss.
Well, he fought yeah. him twice. No, he had the DQ loss, and then he lost him legitimately. Mm-hmm. But his last one with Corey Sandhagen, and he also lost to O'Malley, which I arguably thought that he won that fight. And I hate doing this, but he got
run over by Merab with 11
like everybody
11
right
of
now.
49 takedowns. What a performance.
Yeah. And he's taking on Song Yadong, who is that guy's looked real good. I mean, he did have that one TKO loss to Sandhagen, but you know, he's won three of the last four fights. So why don't you take us off on that?
I'm big on Song Yadong. I didn't know
me
that
too.
He's been in the UFC now for 7 years. He trains primarily at Team Alpha Male, and they've given him a lot of great counter wrestling. He's got awesome movement on the ground. Primarily, he's a stand-up fighter. Yeah. He's so fast.
Great power in his hands.
He's powerful. He's fast. Yeah. And it's interesting because, like, his head kicks and his like lancing crosses are so fast, and they make great highlights, and they show him as this like overwhelming offensive force, and he puts out a lot of really heavy pressure and a lot of great damage, but primarily most of his knockouts seem to come as counters. He is so quick, like, and not just his hands, his whole body is fast. He is in the pocket, landing damaging shots, and he's out so quickly. He's, you know, dipping and ducking and dodging.
You know who he reminds me of is Duho Choi.
Yeah, you know, that Duho Choi has, like, awesome boxing. And the same sort of way where it's...
That speed.
Yeah, it's, like, it's fast, but then, like, when it hits a person, like... Instead of, like, you know what, like, the examples like Conor McGregor, where, like, a big cross is traveling and it hits his opponent and then his hand keeps going through. And for whatever reason, when, you know, for Song Yadong, I've seen it. For Duho Choi was another great call. It feels like their hand totally stops. Like, when they, like, in, you'll see them like slip, uppercut, and their hand makes connection and it does not keep traveling. All the force goes straight into that, you know, their opponent's head, and they go sailing. It's pretty thunderous power for 135 pounds.
No kidding.
I'm really excited for this one. There is a couple of things that I think Song Yadong does well that I think is going to match up well against Yan. He starts really fast, which is one. And Yan isn't necessarily like slow at the beginning, but he ramps up over time. And I think Yadong likes attritive damage early on. So I think if he's landing his like really fast, powerful low kicks and working the body early on, that's going to kind of like slow that ramp that Yan does. And he hand fights really well, which I think is going to benefit him a lot. But what he doesn't do super well is defend inside the pocket. He likes a lot of distance. He likes either closing distance fast or making his opponent close that distance so he can counter them. And when he is forced to be in that middle distance, he struggles a little bit. And that's where Yan is really, really nasty. So I think if this fight goes, you know, into the third round, Yan is going to corner him into, you know, against the cage and puts like combos on him. And I think that's where he's going to be in a lot of trouble.
Yeah. So Peter Yan, his last four fights, all of them have gone to decision. So what you're saying is that if Yan comes on strong, he's got a good chance of taking this fight towards the end of the round, but that means he's got to win round two.
That's
to be
true.
Able to do that. What I like about Yan is that he is really a master at tying different skill sets together. So he's a hard puncher. He's got great boxing. He's got great timing. Right. He's a notoriously slow starter in the first round. But when he gets going, he's got great takedowns. He's got great takedown defense. Out of the both of them, I mean, from an overall strength standpoint, I think Petr Yan's the stronger fighter. I don't know if he's the quicker fighter.
Oh, I doubt it.
But I think he's got more. Yeah, I think he's got more tools to be able to take this. And so, I mean, this is basically a pick'em fight. I just think that Petr Yan has more areas to not have to execute mm-hmm. perfectly, whereas Song Yadong is going to be reliant upon those big strikes, big counter strikes on the feet and maintaining that distance. So I just feel like Petr Yan's got more ways to win, and I don't feel great about this pick, but I feel like I'm going to take Petr Yan, even though I don't know where his mind is right now, given the fact that he's on a 3-fight losing streak.
Yeah, you know, I'm also going to go with Yan. And the last thing I wanted to point out about this was there's a theme here that's going to come up later on in the card, that when Song Yadong, his last loss was against Corey Sandhagen, and one of the things that made that fight so tough for him was Sandhagen's constantly switching stances. And the stance switches not only change your offensive capabilities, but it changes your defensive vulnerabilities. And so
sure.
Yadong has to change his offense all the time to keep up with Sandhagen switching his stances. And that was really like frustrating him and hampering his ability to like make these big lunging like outside shots or counter effectively. And Yan also fights he switches stance very, very well. So I think if he starts that mm-hmm. early, he's going to buy himself time to make his reads while Yadong can't close the distance and make his counters like he wants because of that shifting target that Yan can provide.
Sure. I agree with you. I think from an overall potential standpoint, I think Petr Yan, even though Song Yadong, I believe, is it without a question a top 5 fighter, I think that Petr Yan just got a little bit higher of a ceiling than Song Yadong does at this point. So I'm going to take Petr Yan. So, but it's going to be a heck of a fight, and I think it's going to be razor thin. I think it's probably going to go to a decision. All right, next fight, we have Gilbert Burns, plus 140, taking on Jack Della Maddalena, who's minus 166. And I am really surprised by the Vegas odds. Oh, by the way, all these came from DraftKings mm-hmm. today. So this is the current active line for what it is. And the reason we tell you this is it gives you an idea about who the favorite is and how big of a favorite is. And I just think it's really good information to know how the fight's mm-hmm. being viewed. So what are your thoughts on this?
I think this is obviously like a huge step up in competition for JDM. He is, you know, he's the hot new prospect at welterweight. He is primarily a boxer. He has awesome hands. He works the body. He like changes levels mid combination. He fights behind his jab mm-hmm. super well. He switches stances. He does a lot of really like technically sound crafty boxing. And he does it really, really well. What isn't up to the same level of skill is his grappling. And it's not that he's a bad grappler. He's not, but his grappling,
he's going against a world-class
his grappling instincts are not as strong as Gilbert Burns, or they're not as strong as his striking instincts by a pretty decent amount. His last fight, I think it was his last fight,
it was Holland.
Oh, and then maybe it was a couple fights ago. He fought a guy named Basil Hafez.
Yeah, that was the previous fight. So his last four were Holland, Hafez, Randy Brown, Damian Roberts.
Yeah, Hafez was the wrestler, or the most, like, the strongest wrestler. And JDM, he went to the ground a lot more than he needed to. And I think he was, like, too willing to pull guard, too willing to jump on guillotines, too willing to, like, commit to, like, bad position in order to get a finish or something. And I think that's just a little bit of grappling inexperience, a little bit of still young instincts on the ground.
Yeah. I mean, he's only 27, and that's the issue I have with this fight.
That's big.
Is on paper, it looks like, you know, when you look at their resume, their experience, who they fought, Gilbert Burns should be a shoe-in to win this fight on paper. He's 37 years old.
That's a 10-year age gap.
37 years old. That's, yeah. And I mean, his last four fights. So he lost handedly to Bilal Muhammad. Beat Masvidal, beat Magny, and then lost to Chimaev, which was an amazing fight. What was that, like 2 years ago?
Yeah, 20. Maybe 3 years ago. Almost three. Yeah, 2021. Burns fight is, I take it with a grain of salt. The Muhammad fight. He blew his shoulder out. And yes, that was something that Muhammad did. I think Burns shot in for a double leg and Bilal, like, threw up a knee as Burns was closing in and caught his shoulder with his knee and separated it, I think. And so Gilbert was fighting with one arm for most of that fight. So he was fighting with one arm, but that was due to damage that, you know, Bilal put on him. So I don't want to take anything away from Bilal Muhammad, but I think that was a compromised version of Gilbert Burns. That was also Gilbert Burns who had taken, what does that say? He took the Muhammad fight 1 month after his Masvidal fight. And he made three weight cuts that year. He fought Magny, Masvidal, and Muhammad. So that's three weight cuts in 1 year as a 37-year-old. And two of them were 1 month apart. And I think that contributed a lot to that loss. And that's something I'm going to bring up later as well.
Yeah, but do you think that, you know, I always go back to that, my rules of picking fighters is the will to win. And I think we've determined now that Gilbert Burns is probably not going to be in line for a title shot anytime soon. I think his runway is very, very short for even be able to get there. And I also don't see him. I don't think he's getting another shot at the title. Long story short. So that makes you question, you know, why this is probably considered for him a pretty significant step down in competition relative to the marquee fights he's had before. What do you think that does to his mindset?
I don't think he's taking this one less seriously. I think specifically because of the way he lost last time, I feel like that has kept that fire on him. I think if he had won comfortably, or if he had gotten like blown out of the water, in a non-controversial way, and he got totally dominated by Muhammad, I think that might hamper him a little bit more. I think there's sort of this like feeling of injustice that like I didn't get a chance to really prove myself because of this injury. I think he is still very hungry. I don't know that he will get to a title. I think I agree with you on that, but I don't think that is set in his mind yet.
Yeah. Well, it's going to be interesting to see because, you know, when we talk about Jack being primarily a striker, and that's, you know, that's kind of how we see it. And I remember what Gilbert Burns was able to do to Wonderboy Thompson when they fought. It's hard to make those comparisons direct, but
they're not the same kind of striker, you know, Steven, but I see your point. Yeah.
No, they're not, but Steven's got some pretty good takedown defense. I mean, he's not an easy guy to take down, but he got absolutely dominated by Gilbert Burns. And now I don't see it going like that, but I believe that the odds are off here. I believe that Gilbert Burns has the ability to dictate where this fight is going to take place. And I think if he gets and he lays on Jack for one or two rounds, it's going to really wear on his gas tank. And, you know, I just think it's a pretty big step up, you know, from Holland to Gilbert Burns is a really big step up. No disrespect to Holland, but I think Gilbert Burns is going to take this, and I think he's going to take it. I don't know. Do you think this is going to be relatively handed, you know, take it handedly, or do you think this is going to be a really tough back and forth?
I think Burns is going to lose the first round, and JDM's going to look really good. And I think he might even lose the second round, but I think he wins by submission in the third. Jack Della Maddalena does not have any stoppages in a third round. He's only got two stoppages after the halfway mark of round two. One of them was a doctor stoppage, and one of them was a sub, like, early on in his career. All of his, most of his finishes are in the first round, and he's got a couple in, like, the early part of the second round, where he's, like, following up on damage he did in the first. Gilbert Burns has only been stopped twice, and one time it was in the first round, back when he was cutting down to lightweight, and he got knocked out by Dan Hooker, who can knock out a horse. And the only other person that stopped him was Kamaru Usman at his absolute peak.
It's no shame.
No, and that was in the third round. It was primarily due to strikes. Both of them were. But I can see Gilbert Burns getting pieced up, but I think one of the biggest things that hurts a lot of grapplers, you know, like the Mackenzie Dearns and people like that, is they have tremendous submission skills and grappling control, but they can't get the fight down to the mat. And that's, you know, that happened to Damian Maya too. But Gilbert Burns can get the fight down to the mat, and he does that pretty
reliably.
Yeah,
he's got good wrestling too.
Yeah,
without question.
I think if he gets a hold of Della Maddalena, I think he's going to be able to put some serious damage on him.
I just don't see Della Maddalena being able to get back up. So I think there's a good chance that he loses round two. And I mean, you know, I don't know. I hate calling submissions or anything like that, but I think that this is going to be a long fight for him. And I think he's going to end up getting, I think Gilbert Burns' game plan is going to be try and cover distance early, get a hold on him, do some clinch fighting, which is really good or really well. And then take him down, stay on top of him, and then just kind of grind it out. But, I mean, he's always going to be fishing for a submission. I just don't think that the level between these two is so dramatically different there. That's without question going to be the best place for him to be able to take the fight. So I think that's what he's going to be looking to do. And unlike Kamaru Usman, you know, Usman, you really had to set up the takedowns. Mm-hmm. And so, obviously, you're going to be more opened up to getting countered on the feet because Kamaru Usman's got thunder in his jab and his right hand. So does Jack, but he doesn't have to worry about those takedown or, you know, worry about the takedown defense, you know, and those setups like he's going to, you know, like kind of like he did with Wonderboy Thompson. So, obviously, so, but we're both taking Burns,
I think so. I think he has to walk that line.
We got to make the call.
I think he's going to be able to get him down eventually, and I don't think Jack's going to have an answer for that.
I don't think so either. I agree with you. All right. So next we've got Kevin Holland, one of my all-time favorite fighters, not just because he's really good in the cage, but because of the mouthpiece that guy brings in. Taking on Michael Venom Page, a Bellator guy. He was a champ over at Bellator,
For a while. He fought for the belt. He lost a really, really close split decision against Logan Storley for the welterweight title.
Okay. Because he had he had like the trilogy or something with Douglas Lima.
Yeah, I think by the time he fought Douglas Lima for the belt and got knocked out, and that was only his first ever loss, I think.
Because he's 21.
And then
two.
I think in his rematch with Lima, Lima had since lost the belt to Yaroslav Amosov, I think.
Yeah, that's right. I don't follow Bellator as much as I do the UFC, but I remember Michael Venom Page about 4 or 5 years ago. And who was the guy that he fought? I mean, he looked unbeatable 4 or 5 years ago. Almost had that vibe of an Anderson Silva in his prime, like a scary dude. And I was watching the fight. Tell me the guy's name again that he crushed his skull.
That's Evangelista Santos. Cyborg.
Goodness gracious. Go back and watch that.
Yeah.
if you're listening to this, go back and take a look at that. You can actually see he kneed him in the head, right?
Cyborg shot for a takedown, and MVP timed a flying knee and cracked him right in the center of his forehead. And there, like, concaved it was gross. Disgusting. And then of all things, he threw a Pokeball at him on the ground while he was writhing in pain. This was back when Pokemon Go was super big.
Still big.
He put on a Ash Ketchum hat and threw a Pokeball at this writhing body on the ground, and it was awful.
Yeah. So I've wanted to see him fight in the UFC for a really long time because I didn't know the level of competition that he was facing. So his last four, Derek Anderson, Douglas Lima's a gamer, mm-hmm. for sure, Logan Storley, and Yamuchi, who he beat, I think, last year, TKO via leg kick. So, and originally he was he a karate guy, taekwondo guy? He was a point fighter.
He calls his style hands down kickboxing, but he started both of his parents were Lao Gar Kung Fu masters.
Was it
Kung
Fu?
So they were like a very specific style of Kung Fu is what they studied. And they raised him to do that. And he used that and brought it into like a point karate environment. So he was doing the like lunging in kind of like similar to what Steven Thompson, Wonder Boy did. And they have a very similar style, that point fighting that you mentioned. They do a couple of things different, but it's that like back and forth, hands down, rangy, really mm-hmm. fast distance closing,
wide mm-hmm. stance,
yeah,
the darting yeah. vibe to it. But Michael Venom, but his striking, like the power in his punches, how vicious that guy fights, is unbelievable. Now here's the problem though: he's 36 years old. And this is his first fight in the UFC. He's fought game guys before, like Douglas Lima, a couple mm-hmm. times. But now he's taken on a legitimate veteran with a high ceiling, with tons of potential, and Kevin Holland, who's a little bit younger. He's 31 years old. And, the thing about Kevin Holland, he's been going back and forth on wins mm-hmm. and losses. I think some of the losses that he's absorbed are ones that he could have overcome if he had stuck to his game plan, because we talked about him and his fight IQ. He was loosey-goosey in the UFC for the first like 4 or 5 years, where he didn't really seem to even be taking anything seriously at all. He was basically talking, and they're putting on a show, and if he lost, he lost, and he was okay with it. And then starting with, I'd say Steven Thompson or Ponzinibbio, like he started to turn those things around. I was like, okay, this is the Kevin Holland that I saw flashes of greatness with early on in his mm-hmm. career. But since then, he's had a couple hiccups, and he seems to be trading off wins and losses. But this is a really intriguing matchup because Kevin Holland has A-level stand-up. He's got great jiu-jitsu. I don't know how Michael Page does on the ground, if he's had a lot of what were your thoughts on that?
Well, when I've seen – so he is very good at his, like – in transition sort of defense. Like, he stops a good takedown and he is moving the second his ass hits the mat. Like, he is always trying to get his hips away and stand back up and move out and circle away. So he relies on his stand up and his grappling, like his striking, so much that he has, he's built some good defensive grappling skills. But sure. If he loses a position and he ends up getting like pinned against the cage, he often opts to just like go double underhooks from guard, from guard bottom, and just hold on to his opponent from the top and just stall out. Like, he'll give up a whole round, like just on the bottom, avoiding major damage. And then just kind of wait for either the ref to stand them up, or he'll just let the clock tick and wait till he can start on the feet again in the second round, mm-hmm. which isn't tremendous, but it's how he's avoided
you also have someone that's going to be willing to get you there, where you know, Kevin Holland's biggest weakness, without question, is his wrestling.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean,
yeah. I mean, he got held down by Derek Brunson, who is a great wrestler, and Marvin Vettori, who's a great wrestler.
Not just held down, he got taken down repeatedly by them. And I don't see a lot of offensive wrestling by Kevin Holland.
No.
Which is where I think he's going to need to take it if he's going to have any shot at beating Michael Page, because I think Michael Page is a better striker than Kevin Holland. And I think Kevin Holland's going to be okay with hashing this out on the feet, because even though he might be training takedowns right now to beat Michael Venom Page, I think when the fists start flying, he's going to abandon his game plan and go toe-to-toe with him, just like he does every other fighter that he gets in there with. He's always seems to be like Johnny Walker, where they abandon the game plan and they get into like whether an ego match or an entertainment match, whatever it's going to be, that doesn't necessarily play to his strengths. And I think that's what's going to happen here. So I'm going to take Michael Venom Page here.
Yeah, so this one I have a couple of thoughts, and they go back and forth. I think that
it's a razor thin card.
I think that cards like this. Holland made a conscious decision to like follow this gentleman's agreement with Wonderboy, and he said, "Let's just keep it standing." And I applaud him. I mean, was it the right idea? No. He got kicked in the head so many times that he broke his arm trying to block them all and lost by a corner stoppage. But I mean, he didn't lose anything like stock wise from that fight to make that declaration. I'm going to stand and have this battle on the feet with Wonder Boy is a great, I mean, it was so much fun. MVP, as exciting as he is, does not have the same goodwill, I think, amongst the MMA community at large. I don't know that Holland is going to be as willing to say, like, let's have another gentleman's agreement. Like, it already went bad for him last time. This is a similar situation. And it's not somebody that is... I think he's going to be more willing to at least start this fight, you know, or to initiate grappling exchanges. Where I think he'll...
But can he get it there is the problem.
What I think he's going to have to do is time takedowns, time like reactive takedowns on those big charges that MVP does. When he was fighting Wonder Boy, and Wonder Boy was doing the same blitz, what he's wanting is for his, you know, whoever Wonder Boy charges in, and he wants his opponent to try and, you know, counter him so he can be evasive and recounter and punish those swings. What Holland did instead was, instead of trying to like catch Wonder Boy clean with this left hook, he just reached over past his head and just latched onto him with like a collar tie. And from the collar tie, even if your eyes are closed or your head is down or ducking, you always know where your own hand is, and therefore you know where your opponent's head is. And he got him once really, really good in the first round with like a big long left hook. This is kind of something similar to like Fedor used to do this. He would throw these looping left hooks that would either hit or he would overshoot and latch onto a collar tie. And then he always knew where his opponent's head was, and he could just aim for his own hand. And he's got these awesome like overhook, step in, clinch elbow that he does really, really well. He got Wonder Boy really good with it early on in their fight. When he fought Anthony Hernandez, Fluffy, he knocked him out with that, or he started the finishing sequence with that. They tried to close distance, got that same underhook, was able to circle out, land the big elbow right to his own hand. That is a really, really reliable move because you know where your opponent's head is. But outside of that, like, reliable, hold them still so they can't be evasive stuff, Holland's got his own super unique, like, striking style. and an ability to generate power and from such weird places. Like the big one that everyone will talk about is the Jacare fight, where he was in like guard bottom and did this like kip up wild overhand to knock him out. And in the Ponzinibbio fight, this like jab and he makes himself so long with this like leaping, twisting, reaching corkscrew punch where Ponzinibbio thought he was out of range and Holland is able to just like extend himself and chase in a way where he is able to still land with a lot of power. And it is unlike anything that I think MVP has fought. And for a guy who relies on such narrow margins of like head retractions and like step backs and he because he defends primarily with his head movement and his footwork, he plays a game of inches, and I worry that he's gonna try and play that game and Holland's gonna be able to surprise him and catch him where he thinks he's safe.
Interesting. So you think that Holland, even if he abandons the game plan, has enough tools in his bag to surprise Michael Venom Page? In the striking.
He's a unique striker.
He is, and he's got. And like, this is no disrespect to Kevin, because Kevin is, like I said in the beginning, one of my all-time favorite fighters in the UFC. But I think I'm gonna have to disagree with you. There. I mean, I think against certain competition, he can look really, really good because he is really, really good. But I think that Michael Page is one of those unique talents that while he would never be a title holder in the UFC because he doesn't have a well-rounded enough skill set, I think if he finds someone that's willing to engage him on the feet, that could be a real problem for Kevin Holland. And that's the way that I see this going. I don't think there's going to be a ton of surprises on Kevin Holland's side for MVP, but I might just be naive in the level of competition that Michael Page has faced.
Well, he hasn't faced a lot of high-level competition. hasn't faced a lot of competition in it or wherever he's from. But what I'll say is, because he's fought a lot of cans, he hasn't gotten hit a ton. He's been knocked out once, and for the most part, he's really evasive. That's the same reason that Wonderboy's got such a good chin at 40. MVP actually took a bare-knuckle boxing fight against Mike Perry, and you only succeed in bare-knuckle by being tough. Like even at 36 or however old he was at that time of that fight, you have to be willing to take punches and you have to be durable and you have to have like a lot of heart to do well in bare knuckle boxing. And so that's credit to MVP. I think he's because of his evasive style, I think he still has a lot of miles left on his chin despite being 37 in April.
36. Yeah. Yeah.
So I see your point. I think I'm still going to go.
I'm not very confident.
I think I'm still going to go Holland, but I see your point, and I don't blame anybody who picks MVP.
Yeah. I don't know if I want him to win because I think he's kind of a jerk, for being honest with each other. And Kevin Holland, I think, is the opposite of that. But I just think that Page is going to have his ticket here. So. All right, so we'll disagree on that one. Next fight is Dustin Poirier, 29-8, taking on Benoit St. Denis, 31-1. I didn't realize he had that many fights. Holy buckets.
Benoit St. Denis is 13-1.
And he's only 13-1.
You scared me there for a second. No. You scared me there. No.
Sorry, I typed it in wrong. Got my notes in front of me. Holy buckets. I was like, wait a minute. Shit, this guy's been fighting since he was 16 years old.
Yeah, I think he's actually, he started in 2018, I think I want to say. He's only been a pro fighter for 6 years. And that works against him, and it works for him. This is another fight where there's a pretty significant age gap.
Poirier is 35, Saint Denis is 28. What are the odds on this one? Poirier is plus 170. And Saint Denis is minus 205. That's actually the biggest. He's the biggest favorite on the card at minus 205.
Wow, that's the biggest favorite. That's crazy.
That's the biggest margin. Yeah.
On the main card, at least.
On the main card, yeah.
Poirier finds himself in the same position as Gilbert Burns here. That's a pretty significant step down in the rankings from Justin Gaethje, Charles Oliveira, Conor McGregor, notwithstanding, Michael Chandler. Those guys are all in the top five, and Saint Denis is what, 13 or 11 or something like that.
Yeah,
something like that. He's in the same spot as Gilbert Burns, where now he is coming off of a loss. He has to kind of reestablish himself. He's been fighting the top level of the division for the last couple of years. And this is like a big move from a young contender. This is, I think this is too big a step up for,
it's a huge step
for Benoit Saint-Denis.
So his last four fights, just to put this in perspective, Gabriel Miranda, Ismael Bonfim, or whatever that is, Thiago Moises, and Matt Frivola are his last four wins in the UFC. Whereas Dustin Poirier is McGregor, Oliveira, Chandler, and Gaethje.
Yeah. Dude. That's a totally dramatic. Different. And who was it before that? It was Dan Hooker. And who was it before that? It was Eddie Alvarez. And then it was Gaethje again.
It's who's who.
Yeah. I mean, Dustin Poirier has...
Khabib.
Yeah. I mean, he's only fought like... super, super high level guys for the last, I don't know, decade?
5 years.
It's crazy.
Ever since he beat Max Holloway.
Pretty much. Actually, I have a note from that Max Holloway fight. I think it was like in the third round, I want to say. I don't remember when, but in the corner between rounds, Max Holloway sits down and... he says to his corner, he's blocking weird. I don't understand it. Poirier has that sort of, Philly shell, but he frames out with his forearm really well. He is a very unique defensive stylist, and that is frustrating for a lot of people. He's able to stay in the pocket. It
fires hard.
Yeah, he's able to stay in the pocket. Because he can defend with, with that roll, with his frame, with his head movement, he hits like a truck. He presents a lot of challenges that I'm gonna copy the guys over at MMA on Point. I heard them call him Benny Saint Denny, and I love it.
yeah, that's a great name.
I Benny Saint Denny has not fought anybody like Dustin Poirier, and he's able to kind of get away with just having that dog in him, pretty much, for lack of a better description.
Yeah.
He goes out guns blazing. He dives after takedowns. He's relentless with his pressure. He moves forward. I watched the Bonfim fight earlier today, and right off the gate, he throws a body kick, because I think he's a southpaw, and they're in an open stance matchup, and so he throws a open side body kick and just lands it right on Bonfim's stomach, and he goes, oh, that works, and so he throws like a dozen in the next like 2 minutes. He throws like four in a row at one point. He's just like all gas, no brakes, forward, 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 kill, 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 and that works. Until the exact moment it doesn't work anymore.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, kind of to your point, though, he hasn't fought anyone like Dustin Poirier. Mm. He also hasn't fought anyone like Justin Gaethje or Chandler or McGregor or Alvarez or Habib or whatever it is. You know, there's so many guys. And, you know, one of the things I always said is, you know, the thing that's always going to that typically stops the shiny up and comer is the grizzled veteran or the grizzled gatekeeper. Now, I'm not going to call Dustin Poirier a gatekeeper because he's not. I mean, he's a perennial top five contender. But I think he's got a lot of tricks. Now, the thing that concerns me about Dustin Poirier is he said it in his last interview, and he's been saying it repeatedly over the last 6 months, that this could be his last fight. You know, he doesn't know if this is going to be his last fight. And he's been through so many wars that, you know, he decides afterwards if he's going to do it again. And so what does that tell me is, you know, is his mind in it right now? Is he looking at this knowing that he's probably not going to get another title shot because he's going on, you know, he lost to Gaethje. He's 35 years old. And I don't see him getting, I mean, the exact same place that we see Gilbert Burns in right now. But, you know, to your point, Gilbert Burns does not seem like he is looking to take a step back and maybe still gunning for that title, whereas it almost seems like Dustin Poirier is kind of settled in with the fact that he may not get another title shot, and so he's at the wind down of his career.
I think he's tempered, but I don't know that that's a bad thing, at least in this matchup specifically. I'm going to quote Corey Sandhagen again for the second time in this podcast. He said, and this wasn't about this fight, but I think he mentioned it earlier. At the highest level, just wanting it more than your opponent isn't enough. Everybody wants it. That's why they're at the top. You have to be skilled. He's got a veteran's perspective on his career. This is going to be his 30th fight in the UFC. He got knocked out.
Is that a record? Is he getting close to a record?
He's close, but Jim Miller, I think, is it like
Cerrone?
Jim Miller.
Is it Jim Miller.
Who's
Jim
at
Miller,
like 34 or something like that. He got knocked out in his last fight pretty bad. Hasn't been knocked out a ton, but he has been in wars. But that was almost, let's see, that was almost 9 months ago or something like that. He fought at like UFC 291, so maybe like 8 months ago. So he's had time to recover. He's been back in the gym. He took his rest. He has the patience. He's got the like long-term vision. BSD is, this will be his fourth fight in 8 months. His last one was at 295. And the one before that was like a month in between or something like that. Like, this is his fourth weight cut. This is his fourth training camp. Like, this, like, that takes a toll. It's all cumulative. Like, the reason that, like, five fights in a year is so crazy impressive, I mean, it's just a lot of wear and tear. It's a lot of damage to put yourself through. And, yeah, it looks good. Sure. I mean, Cowboy was the anytime, anywhere, any place kind of guy.
So is Kevin Holland.
Yeah, and Kevin Holland.
And that bit him in
Kevin
the ass.
Kevin Holland won five
that
in the
bit
row.
Him in the
and
ass.
It, yeah, Gilbert Burns. He made it.
Bit him
he
in
made
the
a
ass,
turnaround
yeah.
in just under a month. Alexander Volkanovski took a fight on 11 days notice, and then, you know, three months. I mean, you need time in between. And when you are as young and as hungry and as go, go, go as BSD is, I think you make that mistake. And Poirier is not making that mistake. He's never lost twice in a row, and he is taking the time and he's playing a long game. I think he is going to be, I mean, he's absolutely not going to be as easy and out as you know, Frivola was.
No.
I think that I'm not going to say fraud checked. Because I think that Saint-Denis is great. I think he's got a long way to go. I think he's going to be in the UFC for a long time. I think he's going to do incredible things, but I think Poirier this early in his career is a huge ask, and I don't know that he's up to it yet.
Yeah, and that's what makes the odds on this so confusing.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, to have him be the biggest favorite on the main card seems...
Against Dustin Poirier, who even when he's going against really, really good guys, is often, you know, like Chandler, like Oliveira, I thought I was going to lose. Chandler, I thought there was a good chance he was going to lose. I thought he was going to lose against McGregor. And I'm always underestimating Poirier. And then when I see him fight, I'm like, oh, shit, you know, I got to, like, make sure I don't do that anymore. Mm-hmm. And... I think this is pretty much a shoe-in fight for Dustin Poirier too. And the only concern I have with him is what his mindset is in regards to retirement, and if he's still hungry for, you know, to keep continuing at this mm-hmm. pace, or at least at this level. But that's the only concern that I have, because I think that everywhere the fight can go, he's going to have the tricks of the trade and those experience levels that are going to allow him to slow down BSD, get him tired, counter him. You know, like you said, when he opened up with the body shot and he did that same move like 12 times in a row or four times in a row, but like 12 times in that round, that is not going to work against any of those guys in the top five that have been doing this mm-hmm. for a while. So I think that Dustin Poirier is going to take this, and I think he's going to take it. I think it's going to be a really action-packed first round, and I think it's going to come on strong in round two. And probably not.
I think he's going to put him away. I think it's going to be round three.
Okay. I'm going to call round three as well. All right. Glad we agree on that one. So I think we're, three or four underdogs right now. And then final fight, which is the rematch, Sean O'Malley, Sugar Sean, minus 258 for the bantamweight title, taking on Marlon Vera, who's plus 180. And I think the last fight, when was the last fight they had? Was it 3 years ago?
Yeah, it was a minute. It was
a long time ago. They've been jabbering each other ever since. This is kind of a redemption fight for O'Malley. And, you know, so Marlon Vera is coming off a win against Pedro Munhoz, but he lost to Corey Sandhagen. You know, he looks really good, but usually you don't get a title fight going one and one in the last two fights. So this is definitely about Sean O'Malley and a revenge fight for him.
Yeah.
I think that's how Marlon Vera got here. And so he wants to avenge it. And I think it's pretty cool that he's doing that. I can't say I'm a huge Sugar Sean O'Malley fan just by his antics. Mm-hmm. But, man, is he one hell of a fighter.
Yeah, man. He is, you know...
Surprising. hell of a fighter. Because he looks like he looks like a Subway sandwich artist. I mean, we're being honest with each
you know,
other.
I think that he does have kind of a goofy-looking image. He's got some cotton candy hair going, and he's got, you know, the Lambos and the Twitch streams and the smoke and the weed, and you know, and he's got a whole image.
Yeah, he's a character.
He's very smart. I'm not, like, a good follower. I don't follow, like, all of his content, but I'll check in on his podcast with him and his coach, Tim Welch, and... Both of those guys are very clever. I think they're very well researched. They're very well studied. They have a lot of self awareness, and I think they are consistently underestimated in their intelligence and their skill.
I don't know about skill. Sean O'Malley is pretty high regarded from a skill standpoint.
Yeah, I'll give you that.
On the feet, I'd say.
I think he's a. I wouldn't say that he's a bad grappler either.
He's not a bad. I'm not saying that, but I mean, on the feet, he's like, if he's a video game character, he's like a 99.
Yeah, he's
right. That's how good this guy is, and he deserves it too.
His he does a couple of things really, really well that I like so much. He is the sniper from range, which is great. He maintains his range super well. He stays off the cage really well. He sets up shots really well. He does the same thing. I mentioned this earlier where Song Yadong wants to be on the outside, blitz in, and land damage and then get out, or counter as you're coming in. And O'Malley doesn't blitz in quite so much, as I would say he has longer ranged weapons and strikes from the outside. But in the same way that he is baiting you to come in, MVP does this too, that's when he gets his step back and cross counters and gets his fantastic knockouts like he did against Sterling.
Yeah. He's also got really good feints.
He faints so well. He's got
great setups. Great setups.
Yeah. He shifts stances so well.
The spinning attacks that he does, I mean, he's not throwing in one or two techniques. You're getting hit with the kitchen sink all the time with that guy. And at range, too. So you're dealing with a spinning kick. And then you're doing, you know, he fakes to the body. He's got good body work on him as well. And he is able to maintain distance. Unlike, really, he's such a unique case study in the way that he fights. He's one of the few people that you really can't get a hold of. You know, he is so good at sliding in and out. If you blitz at him, he escapes off to the side. If you're trying to pin him against the cage, he uses his footwork to get back. You always see him glancing back at the cage, shifting left and right. Almost like a defensive Dominic Cruz in a way.
He does this thing. I watched a breakdown of him. Jack Slack put one out, and I think he actually just released it again on YouTube if you want to go check it out. Jack Slack, Sean O'Malley. One of the things that he does for his setups is exactly what you were mentioning. He does that snapping front kick, and he can do that with his front leg, or he'll do that with his back leg. And he uses that for a couple of things. It serves a bunch of purposes at the same time. It's his range finder. It's his range maintainer. That's what kind of keeps him striking from a distance. It serves as a constant threat that needs to be addressed. So if he can stab these front kicks at you, he is landing damage where he can't be hit. And so he's kind of forcing you to make the decision to charge at him, because otherwise you're going to get pot-shotted from the outside. And that's the counter that he's setting up. It also serves as attritive damage. You know, over time, he's putting the ball of his foot in your sternum over and over again. And also, when he throws that kick, especially with his rear leg, he plants it very intentionally, either right back where he started, or uses that to hide a stance switch. And so he'll throw his right leg from his back foot and then drop it in front. And then when he drops that foot, that kind of puts him in a narrow stance, and he uses that to spring out to the side and get his distance or change his angle or things like that. And that's a great tool with a lot of purpose. I think he times all these things so well. He sets up things so well. He punishes mistakes so well. What makes Cheeto such a good foil for him is that he doesn't make a lot of defensive mistakes. Cheeto is very technically sound on the feet. He's not like an amazing technical strike.
It's not flashy.
Not in the same way that O'Malley is by any means, but he is very fundamentally sound, and he has very good defense. He is not providing a ton of openings. He is not making these overcommitted mistakes that get so many people knocked out against Sean O'Malley. So I think that O'Malley will be able to land that damage from the outside, just like we saw in the first match. He was timing those low leg kicks really well. And Cheeto is, like Jan, he's a notoriously slow starter. So I think that right out the gate, O'Malley's going to be able to start putting damage on Cheeto. Those low leg kicks, he's going to try and snap those front kicks and find his angles. I think you were also saying that he throws the whole kitchen sink. And doing that, there's some thought that you don't want to show all of your weapons all at once, because you want to keep some things. You want to have some tricks. You want to be able to meter out how fast you're showing these techniques. But on the other end of that, if you have like such a diverse range of strikes, it's much harder to build reads because you don't get to see the same thing more than, you know, a few times in a round. And if you set them up with different things, if you pair those, you know, your same moves with, you know, moves differently from different positions, from stances, from things like that, it becomes harder to, you know, build your own timing and make your counters. Vera really relies on that. In the Rob Font fight, he won by, I want to say, I think it was a unanimous decision, even though he got outstruck almost 2-1. Rob Font has an incredible jab. He fought behind it. He stayed on it, you know, stayed on him. He outlanded him by a huge margin. But Cheeto was able to make his reads, and even though he lost early in the fight, he was able to, like, build his timing and make his reads, and he was able to land like one or two really damaging shots in the later rounds. And, you know, a fight is judged round by round. So even though he was down, you know, 100 punches to 50, when he landed, it was so much more significant than what Rob Font was putting on him. Mm-hmm. And he could steal a round right at the last, you know, 45 seconds. But
I think Rob Font's quite a bit more hittable.
Right. Yeah. And especially because he's like primarily a boxer, and O'Malley's style is so diverse. So,
sure.
And, you know, and even though O'Malley's a knockout artist, and even though we've seen Cheeto hit like a truck and can knock out so many guys, I really think this is going to go to a decision.
Yeah. I mean, these are two extremely tough guys. And I think that Vera is, you know, he just doesn't have the range that O'Malley does. And because of O'Malley's footwork, I think he's going to be extremely elusive. And what you were talking about earlier, the ability to, you know, to feint, use that teep kick to maintain the distance, is going to be something that's really challenging for Vera. Now, where I think he get in trouble is if Vera starts unloading calf kicks and slows him down early on. Right, if he's able to connect, because that's really what happened. I don't exactly remember how it happened the first fight, but I remember O'Malley basically lost use of one of his feet, and he was fighting just on one foot.
They said Cheeto threw a calf kick, and like his big toe struck his peroneal nerve or something like that, and it gave him drop foot.
Yeah,
and so he didn't even get knocked down. Like there was a clinch. And Cheeto kind of slung him out of the clinch, and O'Malley tried to plant on his back foot and stumbled and hit the ground.
It was pretty gnarly watching, but he actually finished out that fight on literally on one leg.
Are you talking about the Cheeto fight or the Sukumtat fight? And this is true. This is the same leg. This is like a point of weakness too, because that's happened twice now. Where he lost.
I'm trying to remember now.
The Sukumtat fight, he actually hurt his own foot with a head kick. He threw a high kick and hit Sukumtat, and when he planted it, hurt himself. Was on a shaky leg, and should have lost that fight, but Sukumtat took him down like a dummy. And then in the Cheeto fight, he got like kicked. And that's what deadened the nerve, is what I understand. And it wasn't a knockdown or anything. It was like a push, and O'Malley couldn't stand himself back up and hit the ground. And I think because of that, the ref was really quick to stop the fight because he didn't take a ton of damage on the ground. He got hit like once or twice.
No, what I'm remembering, and it's been a while since I watched those fights, but O'Malley was hopping on one leg trying to knee him.
I don't remember that.
It's been a long time since I watched a fight, so I might be misremembering it.
Does sound like something he'd do.
Anyway, it's always stuck out in my mind. I'm going to go back and watch it tonight in bed and try and discern if it was which fight it was. But long story short, I think O'Malley has more tools to win this. I think this is a grudge match. I think the only way that the UFC is going to be willing to have this grudge match is if O'Malley's got a good shot at winning, because from an overall marketability standpoint, Sean O'Malley is really the next big thing. It's the only reason they would even be willing to do this
fight. I think so too.
Right now is because of the star power. So I think it's O'Malley's fight to lose. I think it's going to be a close fight, but I think it's going to end up being a frustrating fight for Vera, especially as we go into rounds 3, 4, and 5, because O'Malley's got one hell of a gas tank. He's really, really hard to take down and pin down. He's got good grappling.
And an iron chin.
You don't see that often because no one... Yeah, an iron chin for sure. But it's really hard to get close to the guy. And you see a lot of people get really frustrated with it.
Mm-hmm.
Really frustrated. So, I mean, if Sterling's not going to be able to take him down and hold him down there for a long period of time, if Peter Yan's not going to be able to get him out, I don't see how Marlon Vera is going to win.
You know, speaking of Sterling, you might have seen this on Instagram, but Aljo put out a video recently saying he heard a rumor. And this is, you know, unsubstantiated, of course, but he heard a rumor saying that Cheeto had a really bad camp and actually struggled throughout the camp for a couple of reasons. So he came out and picked O'Malley because of that, because he had heard that Vera was struggling or had more difficulties during this camp and this training period.
Like he got injured, or
what he said was, I heard that Vera had a bad camp. And that's not anything substantial that hasn't been verified. But that was enough to have Sterling pick O'Malley over Cheeto. Another thing that's going to be different, especially if you're watching O'Malley and Vera 1, is that fight was in the Apex. I watched another breakdown specifically of this fight by a YouTube.
It's a smaller cage.
Correct. Yes. It's a YouTube channel called Sean Talks MMA, and it was an awesome breakdown. If you want to learn, you know, some more about this specific matchup, Sean Talks MMA on YouTube has an incredible video. It's like 8 minutes long, and he has a ton of good points. And one of the things that he mentions is a much bigger cage for this fight, because it's not in the Apex, and O'Malley's going to have a lot more room to navigate than he did when he got, you know, backed up a little bit easier against Cheeto in that first fight, which is back in 2020. Yeah.
That's interesting. Mm-hmm. I think that only helps O'Malley.
Yeah.
I think you're right. So I'm taking O'Malley. What do you want? What do you think? Decision?
I think O'Malley wins by decision.
Clear cut?
Yeah. I think I'm going to be nervous the whole time because Cheeto can win a round in a second. But I think O'Malley's going to be able to stay on the outside. I think he's going to be able to go all 5 rounds. I think it's going to be a decision.
Yeah, I go back to that punch he took from Peter Yan.
Yeah.
Almost put his lights out. If he can take that, I think he can take what Marlon Vera is going to dish out.
What do you think about the pink shorts? Did you hear that? Yeah, he's got pink and gold shorts. For his first defense.
That's
so on brand.
So on brand. I mean, I really don't think he gives a rat's ass about what anybody thinks about him, because he is his own man. That's for damn sure. I don't always agree with his antics, but you know, I think he's like you're saying. I think he's a lot smarter of a businessman than people give him credit for, just because of the way that he looks and holds himself. But everything that guy touches pretty much turns to gold. Whether it's fighting or his podcast or just his overall marketability is just on point. So you got to give him credit there.
All right. So that sounds like...
I think that wraps it up. Yeah. Only an hour and 13 minutes
in. Easy peasy.
We did it.
And we weren't even shooting. We were shooting for 30.
We were shooting for 30. We went way overboard, as we always do, but... You know, we put a lot of effort into these podcasts, so hopefully you guys get a lot out of it. And also, Buck, thank you for all like the deep dives and everything that you're doing on this, because I think that's incredibly helpful to set the stage for each of these matchups with a lot of the information that you're bringing.
No, I really appreciate
all
it.
All these different sites and stuff that you're going to. I think it's really awesome. But we will be back for UFC 300. Please don't be in 2 weeks.
No, it's like March 13th, I want to say. So we've got
March 13th.
April 13th. Okay. What a card that is going to be.
It's going to be, I mean, UFC 300. I mean, they've been talking about this card for 6 months.
Yeah.
And it is going to live up the expectations because it is an amazing card, but this is a great card too. Maybe not UFC level, but this is a surprisingly good card for the fight or the card before UFC 300. Mm-hmm. So I'm not going to overlook this one, but you know, we're looking forward to that. So we'll be posting a video, a recap of all of our picks here momentarily on Instagram and also on YouTube. Please like and subscribe. If you listen to that, it helps us build out and helps us get more content for you guys. So we will be back in a couple of weeks, probably be back and forth on Instagram next week with some of the results. But appreciate everyone taking the time to listen. And we will see you soon. Enjoy the weekend. Enjoy the fights.